Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. My guest today is Sharon Virts. She's the author of Fields of Honor series. While we know the stories of Washington, Jefferson, and Madison, Sharon's research explores what happened when those leaders were gone and their children and successors inherited the responsibility of building a new nation. Her Fields of Honor series, including Mask of Honor and the just-released Bargains of Fate, brings this overlooked era to life through real historical figures and events. The books are available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for everything about Sharon, go to Sharon Virts, V-I-R-T-S, SharonVirts.com, and you can follow her on Facebook and Instagram. And Sharon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today, Ira.
It's a pleasure. So how did you get down this trail of history and historical figures? What were you doing before then? Were you working in real estate? Were you a criminal? What was your background?
Well, could be. I worked for a government. I actually started my own business when I was like 29 years old. And I ended up building a government contracting firm that I sold in 2017. And, never, ever thought I would be an author, that I would do this. But I had just sold the business and had a lot of time on my hands and was probably doing things I shouldn't have been doing. So don't say criminal, but, things I shouldn't have been doing. Gotcha. And I'm on the board of the Middleburg Film Festival, and I had met and become friends with a screenwriter named Anthony McCartan, who wrote The Darkest Hour and The Theory of Everything and Two Popes and Bohemian Rhapsody and a bunch of really fun movies. And really, he really encouraged me to write my first story of my first book, which was Mask of Honor, that has now grown into something else, all because I bought an old abandoned haunted house. Which is where we live. So it all came from some old, historic home that was originally built by one of the grandnephews of George Mason IV, one of our founding fathers. So that's kind of how I started.
Well, that's the most important question that I get from that is, does the plumbing work?
There was no plumbing. Well there was very little plumbing. No, we had to replace everything. I mean, this place was a hot mess. I mean, a hot mess. We had vines growing in, vandals, varmints, you name it. They were creeping around here. And so all new plumbing, all new electrical. There was no air conditioning, so we put that in. We were able to save the floors, but the plaster had to be redone. It was a hot mess. It was built originally in the 1810 timeframe and was part of it had burned and was rebuilt, but it needed a lot of love and care. But the history behind the house is unbelievable, and it inspired not just this book in this series, but another book that I've written as well. And it's just so much history here. So many interesting people have lived here, loved here, and died here. And sometimes I swear I hear their voices.
I understand. Does your family enjoy living in that kind of situation, as you called it, a hot mess, now that it's no longer a hot mess?
Well, it depends. My grandson says he sees a little girl on the third floor, and he just tells her to go away, and she leaves him be. I hear things all the time. We smell baking bread in the house. And the dogs do, too. Our dogs will run after down to the kitchen looking for this bread that is smelling but not baking anywhere that we can find.
Wow. Okay.
But it's fun. I mean, we love it here. These are happy ghosts as far as if you believe in such things. But there's no bad or negative energy here that I ever get. And nothing ever scares me, really. It's just we just kind of know they're around, and at least we think there are. I mean, if you believe in this sort of thing. Not that I do, but there's an energy around this house that when we have a party and people over here, it clearly, you can feel just so positive. And I've had many people who supposedly are sensitive to such things come to me and they go, you know, your house is haunted. Well, maybe.
So from talking to that one person, you got inspired, you sold the company, you have all this time, you're living in a haunted house. Okay, I made that part up. But anyway, you're in this historical house and you decide a series. So how did you decide it as a series versus an individual?
I didn't decide it as a series. So I just wrote the first book, right? I wrote Mask of Honor. Right. And then I wrote my second book, which was called Veil of Doubt, which is interesting in its own right, in that it's about a woman who went on trial for murdering her husband, her aunt, and her four kids. And the protagonist is the attorney who defended her, but his daughter lived in my bedroom over here for, I don't know, 40 years, and she died there. didn't know that when I started this story. So I sort of wrote another book, and then I wrote another book. And then I kept getting a lot of people saying they love Mask, and they, you know, the whodunits are great, but we like the old drama, you know, the old Bridgerton, the old, it's kind of like Yellowstone, but, you know, set in the 1800s, early 1800s. And we got interested in another home up the road here. And it's an old stone manor. It was built in the 1760s. And lo and behold, it was also a Mason, one of the Mason grandsons, George Mason, the fourth grandson, Thomas Francis Mason, lived there. So my son's looking for a house. He's looking to maybe buy this place. So my husband and I help him out. And as I do the history on that house, I learned that Thompson Francis Mason was a very esteemed attorney here locally. He had argued, defended a murderer in a murder trial of a guy named Dennis McCarty. Well, Dennis McCarty, the protagonist of my first book, Mask of Honor, is Jack McCarty, who's behind me there. You see him over my shoulder.
Armistead Mason also is involved in this story.
Right. So Jack McCarty's cousin, Dennis McCarty is Jack McCarty's cousin. So then I look into Dennis and Jack, and I find out that Jack is co-counsel with Thomas Francis Mason in that murder trial. So then I go, oh my gosh. And this happened in 1826, 1825 timeframe. So I said, I got to write a sequel. And then when I pitched it to my publisher, they said, no, not a sequel. We want a whole series. So that's how it went. And now the third book in the third installment will be released next March. It's called Swamp of Lies. So there'll be three so far. I committed to five, but I'm not sure I can do it in five, Ira. I may have to do it in six, but we'll see what the publisher says about that based on the sales of all these. So
now when you're researching this, because you live in a historic house and haunted house, evidently, you have to rely on, I assume, libraries to do your basic research. And I assume in the area that you're in, there are historical societies and libraries that have reference material that go back to the 1800s.
Right. Well, a lot of it, you know, in a lot of places was destroyed during the Civil War, especially in the South. We had a really interesting clerk of the court during the Civil War, a guy named George Fox, who preserved all the records and wouldn't let the Union burn the courthouse. So we do have that luck of having the courthouse records. We have the Thomas Bulch Library here, which is a historical library, and of course, the Library of Virginia and the Virginia Historical Society down in Richmond. But George Mason also has a library, the local university here. And George Mason has some of those old account books, those old ledgers. And so the Raspberry Plain, which is the neighboring farm here, the owners were the same, the executors were the same. And so therefore, they actually have Selma, our house, some of the records of that as well in their archives. So, yeah, I'm able to do a lot of that. But, you know, I do a lot of my work on Ancestry.com. I like to know who's related to who, and what, you know, when were they, how many siblings did they have, and when did their parents die, and how young were they when they got married, and how many children did they lose, and all that ancestry goes into creating, in addition to their writings, of course, if I can find those, this persona or this profile of these people. So I use Ancestry a lot. I love to dig into the old archives of newspapers from the Virginia Chronicles, newspaper.com. You can find all kinds of interesting things there. And the good news is these men published a lot. They had a lot to say, and they put it in newspapers, kind of like our Twitter, like our X, but, you know, right. It was more. And so you can read a lot of their disputes with one another, with their opinions on things like nullification or on slavery or on whatever, what tariffs, taxes, you name it. I find a lot of that in the newspapers. Okay. And they're not really, they're not digitized. They're imaged out there, but you've got to have to read them physically.
Most authors I talk with and who are doing a lot of research, I always like to give out, and they usually like to give out a shout out to research librarians, because they are very helpful in terms of when you're trying to find something and you have no idea where in the library system it is.
Yeah. We have a wonderful library here. Alexandra over at Thomas Bulch Library has been fabulous. Lauren is now over there and her staff, her team. I think Alexandria retired. So, but they've been fabulous. I'm actually the president and chairman of the board of trustees for the Loudoun Museum. So I have my own access through my museum directors that, you know, help me out when I need to ask a question about something or can put me in the right direction. So yeah, I'm huge in history. So, and I have my own library. I collect stuff from all over the place. So
it's funny because your personality is such that I could see you throwing parties at the house all the time rather than sitting down and writing a lot of history.
I do both. Well, I'm a fast read. And when I was younger, my mind had a much better memory. So I do hold some stuff back, but I just love history. My father was a storyteller. My grandmother was a storyteller. You know, when I ran my business, I had about 5,000 employees nationwide. And, you know, I would tell stories on video. I'd go out to sites and I'd tell stories about how important the work that they were doing was, and, you know, making it, you know, relatable, how important the missions that we supported were. And so I just think that that's one of my best ways of communicating is through storytelling. And I tell stories at parties. So
well, it all works. Yes,
I've never met a microphone I don't like.
Well, when you start to research all these historical figures and you start, we know about the founding fathers. We're not sure who came after them. But your books are based on research, but they're also fictionalized.
Yes.
So how do you integrate those two things? In other words, you're doing great research. You're using a lot of resources, including Ancestry.com, as you mentioned. But at some point, you have to take that and write it into a fictionalized account. Have you ever thought about writing a nonfiction version of all that research that you've been spending time doing?
You know, someone asked me that recently, and I said, oh my gosh, I'd be afraid I would take too many liberties with it, you know, because I have my own opinions of what's happening. And then the bibliography would be impossible. But no, I hadn't really thought about that so much. As much as I try to stay, when I write, Ira, I try to stay true to the spirit of the story, right? So they're all based on true events. I'm not that clever. I can't come up with this on my own, right? So I have to sort of go where it takes me. Right. But then I have to fill these gaps in. And then, I always get yelled at because the pacing's too slow. So I have to hurry things up and combine events and combine characters and do things that make it more commercial. So, because my attitude is if no one reads it, then what's the point? You know, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing it for the next generation, even though I love doing it. You know, I want to tell these stories. You know, when our country was founded, they didn't leave a roadmap. They left the Constitution. They didn't leave a plethora of court cases. They didn't give a how-to guide. You know, these men and women are struggling with, you know, how to set a country in the right direction and with their own ambition, you know, pulling against that. How do we do that? And how do we keep ambition out of the way? Or how do we use ambition to help us go there? You know, because corruption was cheating in elections, corruption. What's the old thing? There is no conflict of interest if there's no interest.
There's no honor among thieves. That might be better.
Yeah, honor among thieves. Absolutely. So when I research historical figures like Henry Clay, or I'm working right now, you know, with Henry Clay and Charles Fenton Mercer. And Mercer was the man who came up with the Little River Turnpike. And then, of course, the C&O Canal. And, you know, these men would, you know, charter a company to build these canals for the federal government, for the United States, and then vote themselves in charge of it and issue most of the stock to them and their friends. I mean, that's the epitome of conflict of interest. That is the epitome of, you know, enriching yourself.
I think they call it crony capitalism.
Crony capitalism, right. That was going on. Yet it's interesting. The protagonist, this guy behind me, Jack McCarty, I write about, had a huge problem with that and was pretty loud in the newspapers about it, thought it was wrong. And so, you know, I've got a hero here who does have a conscience, but he's got a temper. He's got a temper and he can't suffer a bully. And those two things put him on a dueling field more times than he should have been on there, because, you know, he had to stand up and defend his words. And back then, you know, unlike today, where we can just say what we want on Twitter and haven't got to go out, or I'm sorry, on X, and you haven't got to go out there with a pistol and defend that. Back then you did. Even when you were right, if you offended someone enough, they would call you out. And if you were not to answer that call, then you were labeled a coward. And to be labeled a coward would be to ruin your reputation, hurt your family's ability to, you know, your economic security and your position and your name. And so those things were pretty fragile and pretty important back then. And so people had to be careful what they said. But there were plenty of people, plenty of men, like a guy named James Callender and others, who were Tom Ritchie, the scandal mongers, the men that ran the newspapers, and they would publish all kinds of stuff and get away with it, just like we have today.
Exactly. Can you recommend people reading the books in order, or is it okay if you read it in reverse order?
You can read it any way you'd like. Yeah.
So I call Mask of Honor and then Bargains of Fate, or I can go Bargains of Fate and then Mask of Honor.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So now I'll tell you, in my opinion, I think because Mask of Honor is my first book, obviously I've learned a lot since I've started writing, and my writing's a lot cleaner. Although they did a great edit on the last redo of it, and it's much better, in terms of it being clean. Mask of Honor has got a lot of romance in there, and a lot of Jack's temper. You really get to see him as a young man growing. So the only callback is that you will know how Mask of Honor ends when you start Bargains of Fate, because you know who lives and who dies. But you can do it's a quick Google search. You can find that out anyway, because these are public guys.
Right.
Bargains of Fate is more about Jack's dealing with the fallout of that duel and him attempting to, become a man. He's married now, and he's trying to reconcile his name in society and also his ambition and that of his brother's ambition and where he sees himself in the world versus where everyone sees him. And so he struggles with that. And that's what that book Bargains of Fate about. It's about living with the consequences of our choices, whereas Mask of Honor is a book about forgiveness. So if you're in the mood for some forgiveness, then Mask of Honor is your book. If you're in the mood for, I got to deal with my nonsense, then I think Bargains of Fate is for you.
I'm always guilty about something. So I'll go with the forgiveness with Mask of Honor first and then work my way the other way. You mentioned about that. You think it could go several more books in the series. I would suspect that given your proclivity towards research, you could actually write, I don't want to overburden you here, but you could probably write 10 or more books in that series.
Oh, I could. Oh, I could take it on forever. I love this story. I love this man. I love his conflict in life. I love his, I want to strangle him sometimes because he gets himself into these messes, but I love his honor and his character. I will tell you that the way the books work is that each book starts with a duel scene. It's not the start of the book, but it's, the prologue is, a flash forward to the duel that's going to happen. And it's in everyone. And in real life, Jack McCarty was involved with all the duels that I am putting out there. The books are not about duels, by the way. These books are not about dueling. It's not it's not Hamilton. Okay.
Gotcha.
It's much deeper than that. And they all end, the epilogue is the same, and it progresses through the series. It's from 1852, and Jack is on his deathbed. In real life, he had gone to Wisconsin and then Detroit. He was actually the founder of Milwaukee in a lot of ways. He had bought a bunch of land in Milwaukee, a bunch of land in what is now Milwaukee, I should say, and what is now Detroit, and had gone there to receive an award and became ill on the way back. So he spends about 2 weeks there dying. And so the epilogues are me writing his last words is just reflecting on that particular chapter in life. And the first sentence of every epilogue is actually from his writing. So you'll get a sense of his voice. And I've tried to preserve as much of his dialogue as I can in the novels themselves. But the epilogues, for certain, the first line of every epilogue is from one of Jack's letters or one of his newspaper articles or something that he had written. So we get a sense of that. And I think it's kind of special, especially when you hear his voice and what he cared about. And he really cared about, doing the right thing when the right thing is difficult and not particularly popular, but he wasn't afraid to do that. Now he struggled with it, but he talks about, his want to garner the respect of, of decent women and good men, trying to do the right thing always. And so it's a kind of an aspirational character we can all, look up to and say, yeah, he's flawed. He's got lots of flaws. But there's that honor there and that moral code that I think all of us could really learn from a lesson from today. Not just us, but our political leaders, everybody. I just think it's something that, when you wrestle with your own ambition versus what's the right thing to do. Jack McCarty typically chose the right thing, even when it cost him something, even when it put him on a dueling field and his life was on the line.
It's a very old-fashioned concept that you're dealing with here, which is honor and dedication. But when you finish the book, I would say your editor certainly would be a critic and would go through the book with you, but I would think your harshest critics would be your family. Did you share the book when you first wrote Mask of Honor? Did you share it with them? And what was the feedback?
Oh, yeah. Well, my boys all think that they're all trying to figure out which one of them is Jack McCarty based on.
Main character syndrome. Okay.
Yeah. Mom, it's me. No, it's me. It's interesting. I have four boys, and the book's Mask of Honor starts with the four brothers. Now, we dwindle down to just two in the end because they end up dying of disease mostly. Not in Mask or in Bargains. You'll figure it out as we go through the series. But right. They all try to figure out which one they are. But yeah, they all read it. My husband reads a lot of it. He helps me with the editing often because, you know, I've got to have a pretty sharp book when I turn it over. So he's read it 1,000 times. And I don't know that my mother passed away last year. I think she read my Whodunit book. She couldn't get into this one. She said that they drank too much. Language was bad. I said, okay. You know, I think they said Christ a couple times. I don't know.
But you could have told her, well, that's just the history of it. It's not me.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, they pretty much drank all the time.
Yeah, well, look what the times they were living in.
Well, water was dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. With alcohol, at least you can disinfect. Well, when you're writing each novel, I'll call it a novel. Is that fair? Novel?
Yeah, that's what they are. Yeah.
When you're writing each novel, I'm always curious about how you're, not to bore anybody, but the writing process for the individual people I talk with. In other words, some people will write all day long. Some people write an hour a day. Some people will walk and then write. And some people will just write when the feeling hits.
Whatever. So what happens, I'm one of these all or nothing kind of gals. So I am, when I get into it, I am 24/7. I'll, get up at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. I can't sleep. And I'll just start writing. And I'll write all day. And I'll write all night until I pass out and fall asleep. And then rinse and repeat. Yeah, I do the same thing over and over again until I am stuck. And then I can't go anywhere. Then I'm done. And then I'll go to my art studio and I'll paint. Or I'll work on another book. I've got three books going at once at all times. Because otherwise I have to be in the research phase, the writing phase, and then the cogitating, whatever phase.
I think they call that schizophrenia, but I may be wrong.
Or something. Or I'll go out and garden, or I'll go out and take the dogs for a walk, but then I'll go for maybe a couple of weeks without writing a word. But I'm very organized about my writing, though. I can't write until I have it all laid out. And I write my last chapter first.
Interesting.
I don't know where I'm too ADD. If I don't know where I'm going, I'm never going to get there. I'll be off here. I'll be off there. I lay it out on a timeline. I use a lot of, I'm going to go into my desk in a minute. I hope I don't make your camera swirl, but I use a lot of these kinds of things all over the wall.
The old post-it notes. Yes.
A lot of these listening. Paper notes, right, that match the colors.
Yeah.
And each character is a color, and I put them along on the walls based on a timeline. And then I combine and, I sort of come up with my whole storyline. But there's two parts of a book, right? There's the plot itself, and then there's the character arc.
Right.
And, they have to align. And a lot of writers I know struggle with that. They'll do the plot first, and then they'll kind of shove the character arc back in. And I kind of know what the plot is because I know what happened in real life. So then I got to figure out how I'm going to twist my character up over that. And so I kind of go with that side. I'm more character driven the way I write. So I'm really worried about, so where is he? What's going to break in? How am I going to twist him up some more? And then how is he going to end this one or she, depending on the story. And even though Jack McCarty is my protagonist in the story, his wife, Lucinda, his sister-in-law in Bargains of Fate, Fanny Lee, she plays a huge role, and her arc is in there as well. We won't see her in the third book, but you see her in the fourth. This is the one I'm writing now. I've got about 50,000 words written already, I think, in that one. So there's more than just one protagonist. So you won't get bored with just Jack if you want a woman in your life like this. I've got plenty of women that are in my stories as well. Women are interesting back then. You know, we have very little historical information about them. So you have to glean what they were like from their husbands or their brothers or their fathers or whatever you can get out of a diary, if you're lucky. Yeah.
Two other quick questions. In terms of the writing, just because of the house you live in, I have this image of you sitting there with a manual typewriter or a quill.
I have both, but I don't use either. I actually have a manual typewriter underneath my feet that my grandson plays on. And I do have a quill. My husband and I are into old quills and old pens. And so we have a couple quills. We have a lovely pen that was made from ox bone. And we even have, he had this done for some reason. I went to the University of Virginia. He went to the University of Pennsylvania. For some reason, he's obsessed with Jefferson, and I'm not. But he had Jefferson's ink remade, the actual formula that Thomas Jefferson used in the ink. And he likes to write in his journal with it. He doesn't use a quill. He uses one of those dip pens, the nibs. But that's his thing, inks and pens.
So you're telling me that you actually use a computer then with... Even though
yes, I use my laptop. I write in Word.
And does your family, you mentioned about once you get going, you're doing it 24/7. Does your family know that you're going to get this way and they give you the space?
They leave me alone. They know. When I was writing Mask of Honor and I was writing the Armistead character, I would tell them beforehand, I'm writing Armistead today, so don't come near me. I'm going to be in a movie. They kind of knew what that meant. Yeah. So.
One last question before I let you go. What would you like people to take away from reading those two books from the series? Again, it's the Fields of Honor series, Mask of Honor and Bargains of Fate. What would you like people to take away from reading these books?
I think the most important thing is that even though these stories and these men lived 200 years ago, that their plight is not that much different from our own. You know, they struggled with the same sense of, you know, worry for the country, worry for their families, worry for themselves, love, loss, honor, grief, all the things that, you know, struggles with ambition, guilt, shame, all the things that we feel, all the things that we're faced with in uncertain times. They were just as uncertain, if not more uncertain, than they are today. I mean, they weren't easier times. They weren't harder times. They were the same times, just different circumstances. And I think there's a lot we can learn from them. This honor culture, there's a lot to be said for it. No, I don't advocate for anybody picking up a gun and going out and, you know, blasting your way against your enemy. But I think that the root of what's behind it is that there's a lot that we can do through compromise and looking at things through others' eyes and working together. There's a lot that we can accomplish, a lot more we can accomplish that way than standing across the field from one another or standing across the aisle from one another in Congress or on different sides of left versus right. There's a lot we can learn from that culture today and take forward and understanding that we're not that far apart. I really believe that to be true and that they were struggling with a lot of the things we talk about today, they were talking about then. Frankly, there were, you know, tariffs, there were taxes, there were economic worries. There were states like South Carolina back then talking about seceding from the union, the nullification movement, big banks, privatization of government functions, private industry, all of the things that we talk about today. If you were to just change the date on the newspaper, I'm telling you, they read very similar. So we're not alone in this. And I think we can learn a lot from history. And I think we tend to not want to because we think it was a different time. It wasn't. It's our time, still our time. We have a lot to learn.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Sharon Virts. She's the author of the Fields of Honor series, including Mask of Honor and the just-released Bargains of Fate, and brings this overlooked era to life through real historical figures and events. The books are available on Amazon, BarnesandNobleBookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for anything about Sharon, go to Sharon Virts, V-I-R-T-S, SharonVirts.com, and you can follow her on Facebook and Instagram. And Sharon, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure talking to you today.
Same here. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.